Straw Poll from Bonn, who is giving our first joint venture of the Distinguished Women in Math Colloquium and the Grasp Lecture Series. And she will tell us about crystal bases, Hecke algebras, and equivalences of categories.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much for the invitation here. So actually, I won't talk about crystal bases and Hecke algebras very much, but they will be in the background, and they will play a really, really important role. So what I want to do is I want to make a little bit of advertisement for categorifications, and we want to give some examples of these things and why we should do this. So let me start with some warm-up. Very easy. We want to look at the representation theory of the Lie algebra SL2. So representations. Of the Lie algebra SL2. And I'm always working over the complex numbers, so everything is completely easy. So these are matrices, A, B, C, D, of complex entries, and trace 0, so A plus D is equal to 0. So and then we look at representations, again, over the complex numbers. So that means a vector space V, which has the action of this SL2C. So let's choose a basis of this SL2C as usual. We have E and F and H. And we have the Lie algebra relations. HE is 2E, HF is minus 2F, and EF is H. And now, the basic statement is that if we look at finite dimensional representations of SL2C, so finite dimensional vector spaces over complex numbers where operators EF and H act with these commutator relations, and we want to have them irreducible, so there's no proper submodule which is stable under these EF and G, and H, sorry, and do this under via identify them when they are isomorphic, then this is nothing else than bijection to natural numbers by just taking this representation V and associate the dimension to it. So for each natural number n, there's exactly one finite dimensional representation of SL2C up to isomorphism, which has this dimension. So now I want to denote the representation of dimension n plus 1 with V n. So let me write this representation down completely explicitly. So I choose a basis of this vector space. So it's n plus 1 dimensional. I choose V naught up to Vn, the basis vector. And then the action is like this. So I denote. So let me first write down the formulas. E of Vi is E plus 1 Vi plus 1. F of Vi is n minus I plus 1 Fi minus 1. And H of Vi is 2i minus n times vi. So here's an example for n equals to 2. So I have three basis vectors. And then I have my action. So this would be v0, v1, v2. And I have my action of e going up, but multiplying here by 2. And my action of F going down, and multiplying here by 2. And then the action of H, like this, multiplication with 2 here, multiplication with 0 here, and multiplication with minus 2 over there. So this is the an example for the three-dimensional representation. And what I want to do this is now I want to categorify this. So what I want to do next is say what a categorification is without saying why we should do this. I want to explain what it is, and this will be a bit technical. Then afterwards, I want to give an application why this was useful or an idea why it was useful, and at the end, I want to apply this to not invariants. So this is the the game. So I start with the first thing. So the problem is there is no real definition of categorification. So I have to give you several definitions, and they will increase in the complexity, but they also will increase in how useful they are, I think. So the very easy sense maybe I shouldn't use the word easy. Let me call it weak, because it's not really easy. So it's a very easy sense. So we have given such a finite dimensional module for SL2, and we want to find a category C, and you can put whatever sort of conditions on C. For instance, K-linear, or abelian. Or if you want, it can be triangulated. And whatever. So I say you in a second what you need at least. So such find a category together with an isomorphism of vector spaces. As follows. So we take our category C, and we want to associate this category with this vector space, so categorify this. So V is our module, which we want to categorify. So what we do, we take the category and we take the K group of it. This would be a group, and we complexify this. And we want to have an isomorphism of vector spaces here. So maybe I should I recall what the K group is? So if you are topologists, then it's not the K group probably you think of. So I want just to say it's the following thing. So this is the free abelian group of isomorphism classes of C, of objects of C, isoclasses of objects in C. So modulo the following relation. So isoclass, if I have an object M, I denote the isoclass by bracket M. And then I want to have the relation that the class of C is equal to the class of plus the class of B if there is a short exact sequence in my category of the form where I have A is a sub-object in C and intersects onto B. So here, of course, I need something on my category, so I should use either abelian or triangulate it, and then short exact sequence would be distinguished triangle. So such that this notion here makes sense. This is what I need. So maybe we should do one example to make clear what this thing is. Yeah. So the easiest example is a category which everybody knows. Say we take C mod, which is finite dimensional vector spaces. Okay, with linear maps. So, and then of course we can write, for instance, our one-dimensional vector space as a sub-vector space of the two-dimensional one, and then the quotient will be, again, one-dimensional one. So that means we have in this quotient group that the two-dimensional one is twice, so the class of the two-dimensional one is twice the class of the one-dimensional one. So or in general, if you repeat this argument, the n-dimensional vector space is just n times the class of the one-dimensional vector space in this abelian group. So that means my K naught of this category C here will be just isomorphic to the integers Z, which is the usual addition. So that means if I complexify this, I would just get a one-dimensional complex vector space. So in other words, what we categorized using this category is a one-dimensional vector space. So, but what I wanted to say here is we want to categorify V, where V is a module for SL2, like this. So we also should not only take our vector space, but we should also categorify these actions of these, of this E and the F and the H. So that means this definition is not good enough, so I have to put a little bit more. So we find a category which has this property, plus, so this is now the rest of the definition, and X at functors E and F and H such that the induced maps from this. So here, which I have to give a name, so let me call this C bracket. So this is from C to C, satisfy the SL2 relations. So what do I mean here? So given my category C, I want to have for each of these generators E, F, and H an exact functor from C to C. So this exact functor will then induce a map on this quotient group here, a linear map. And this should be exactly the one which they should satisfy these SL2 relations. Yeah? This is what I mean by a very weak categorification. Okay? So, and now, of course, I want to do an example of this thing. So, the very stupid, very weak categorification is by just taking this example we had here. So, we have already a category which has a one-dimensional complexified quotient group. So, that means if I just take say n copies of them, I get at least the size of an n-dimensional representation. And I just have to define the E's and the F's. So let's do the stupid easy case. So example. And let me just do this case n equals to 2. So V2 is my V. I want to categorify this. Okay. So I take the categories which I want to write as a sum of three of them, which indicates exactly this decomposition into weight spaces of this module. And I want to say, okay, each of them is just my old category of finite dimensional complex vector spaces, and I just take the direct sum of them. Okay? So and the quotient group, we saw this already, is now when I complexify three-dimensional, so a basis of this C would be I take here the class of the module C in this, or I would take it here, or I would take it here. Yeah? So this inclusion means I take C inside here, but then I take the class in the quotient group. Okay, so this is the vector space, and now I need the functors, the E's and the F's, and the H, which satisfy the relations of SL2. Okay, this is quite easy what I have to do. So my E has to go like this, like over there. So if I say E restricted to C minus 2, maps N to M, and this is vector space in C0, so it's just more or less the identity. And if I were restricted to C0, I would just map it to twice M. So this is now an object in C2. So this means here I would get the identity and here twice the identity, which is exactly what I want to have over there. And for F, similarly, going in the other direction, so I would take here the identity and here twice the identity. And then my H, this should just do on this space twice the identity. So identity plus identity. In the middle, it should be the zero map, the zero functor, and then twice the identity. Okay, and you check the relations, and you get the SL2 relations we had before. So, but of course, this is not what you should do. This is completely silly. Everything, is too easy. So the idea is to pop this a little bit up to something which is nice. So I give you a new one by just changing this example a little bit, yeah?
Where was the negatives? What's the negative?
Here.
Yeah.
It comes from the relation. So EF minus FE is H. Okay? So let's...
In your categorical case, do you have...
This is this minus... So I do my E and my F on this space. This gives a functor, twice the identity. But then I have to do minus as a linear map.
Where's the minus 2 eigen, whatever,
So I just say this expression here is, so let's start on this space. So I first do the E, and then I do the F, but I do it with a minus sign on the linear, as a linear map. Yeah? Then I have the relation, it's 2. It's minus 2.
What does that mean? The tensor and the minus 2 in the vector
space? Your category is modulus, right? What is the negative of the modulus in your category?
No, my functor is twice the identity. But what I say is that this on the quotient group, this relation holds. Which is this. Or if you want, write it on the other side with a plus here. Yeah? Does this answer your question? Yeah? Just write it. On the other side, you get rid of the minus, you get a plus, you have the same relation. Or if you want, I was really careful by saying it's a very weak thing. I only said it has to hold on the quotient group level. I didn't say it has to hold on the functor level. So this equation doesn't make sense with the minus sign on the functor level. Yeah? At least not yet. Yeah? It will come later. Yeah. More questions? Good. But now I wanted to change this silly, somehow, categorification into a more interesting one by just changing it a little bit. So, and what I want to do is change this in the middle. To modulus over this ring, Cx mod x squared. So, and my basis is on the outer sides the same thing, and in middle, I want to take this module as a module over itself. Okay? So, I have to tell you now what the E's and the F's are. So, if I start here and go up here, I go from modules over C to modules over this ring, so I can define E restricted to C minus 2. As the induction from C to Cx modulo x squared, which is just defined tensoring with this ring. one-dimensional, yes. It's that this thing has the same Grothendieck group, and what I wrote here is a... This is twice the C. And here is a thing. So I was complexifying this Grothendieck group. So both of these guys form a basis vector. So if I would work over the integers, this wouldn't be true. And this is a quite interesting thing. This is, I would say, categorically the reason that this thing has infinite global dimension, this ring. So I could express this one-dimensional module C in terms of a projective resolution in this guy, and it would have infinite projective resolution. Yeah? So dividing by two is still somehow possible, but in terms of power series. Okay, well, it's a good remark. So I can define this E going from here to here by taking this induction, and then going from here over there, I take just the restriction. So E restricted to C0 is the restriction. So I end up here. And for F, I do exactly the same. And the H is then defined in... Yeah, you can just calculate it. So, and let's check if we start here with C and we induct, we get this space here. Then we restrict, we get this vector space. Yeah, considered as a vector space, it's two-dimensional, so that means we get this multiplication with two. Yeah? So, but what is the advantage example to the other example? The advantage is that I have this basis, which let me call this canonical basis or crystal basis. And we have the other basis, which is the somehow the old basis, just by the one-dimensional modules. This I call the dual canonical basis. Or crystal basis. And if you know a little bit about quantum groups, there is a definition of canonical basis by Lustig and of crystal basis by Nakajima. So they are nice basis of modules for finite dimension modules for Lie algebra. And these are exactly the ones you get via this categorification in this easy example. So that means that for me, the big advantage of this example in comparison to the old one is that at least we get several different bases for free by taking, in this example, in this first basis, the projectives, and here the simple objects of my category. So, and in fact, you can generalize this to any n, so not just for n equals to 2, by doing the following thing. So let me put this just here. So this is a remark for people who know a little bit about cohomology ring of Grassmannians. What you can really do for Cn is you can take the category of cohomology rings for Grassmannians, where n is this m, and you sum over all I. So in this particular example here, we would take a cohomology ring of a point, cohomology ring of P1, which is one-dimensional spaces in two-dimensional space, and here cohomology ring of a point, again, which is two-dimensional spaces in a two-dimensional space. Yeah? And then you have maps which go from the cohomology ring of Grassmann in IN to the space which are flags. So I have a flag of dimension I and one of dimension I, space of dimension I, space of dimension I plus 1 contained in C to the N. So I can forget here the I plus 1 space. I can forget here the I space. So I would get a map. This is included in here, this is included here. On cohomology, I get maps like this. And then I can define my E and my F by taking a module over here, pull it back to here, push it forward to here. Yeah? So in this example here was just a special case of this more general thing. So I put this as a remark to see that this works in general.
Yeah? Explain again, what's the factor, what's the extra terms that are divisible by x by you? I mean, I'm not seeing the difference between the canonical and crystal bases and how that different.
Okay. So here, this is one basis. This is the other basis. Yeah? So let me denote this by V0, V1, and V2, as over there. So then this would be, say, V upper 1, V upper 0, V upper 2. Then V upper 0 and V lower 0 is the same. These are also the same. But there's a difference here. So V lower I is twice V upper I. V lower 1 is twice V upper 1. Because this is a two-dimensional space which is filtered by these guys. So I have, let me write this down. So I have C x modulo x squared has a quotient C, just mapping x to 0, and then you have a subspace like this. So in the quotient group, this thing would be the same as this thing plus this thing. Yeah? So, or in other words, this basis vector is twice this basis vector. So this basis vector is twice this basis vector. Or in opposite, this one is a half of this.
So if we're just going back to thinking of this representation as just being 3x3 matrix, you've just done a change of basis in the second coordinate of rescaling by 2.
Yes. Yeah, that's all. There's nothing more. Yeah. But what I say is that you have, you got this by a natural construction by choosing here natural modules. Two ways. Yeah. So this somehow this scaling by 2 is somehow better than scaling by 3, I would say. This, yeah? So, now the question is, we have now at least two categorifications for this V2, and there are many more for this Vn. The question is, are there ones which are better than other ones, and can we make it somehow unique? So can we change this definition here to get a unique answer to our problem? And the answer is, in this setup, for finite-dimensional irreducible modules for SA2 is yes. And in general, nobody knows. And this is a big question, I would say. And I at least would like to know this in general. So to do this, I want to go now to the next step, from very weak sense to weak sense. So weak sense. So, and this goes back to Chuang and Rupier. Chuang and Rupier. So, what is a categorification in a very weak sense? In a weak sense, it's one which is, of course, one which is very weak. But then, we have additional constraints. So we have some conditions on our category, which I just write down. So some finiteness conditions, which is Artinian and Noetherian, and K-linear. And now they really want to have abelian. So they are nothing like triangulated categories. And the second thing is endomorphism rings of simple objects are just the scalar K. So if you don't know all these words, just think of a finite dimensional algebra which is described via some quiver and relations, and then you have all these conditions if you look at finite dimensional modules over this algebra. And then what we want to have for our functors E and F, they should be adjoint. Okay. And of course, still exact. So, and then there's a condition which we had in all these examples. Namely, all these examples had the condition that the simple modules in the categories are afterwards weight modules when I view it as a module for SL2. So our H was acting on the class of the simple modules always by a scalar. So this is what they want to assume. Simple modules or simple objects are weight modules. Are weight vectors, sorry. So under this identification of the Grothendieck group with the with our vector space, they should be mapped to weight vectors. And then the last thing is F is isomorphic to a left adjoint of E. So these are quite technical conditions already, and this sounds a bit strange here, but this is the weakest thing you can take. So if you are unhappy with this, just assume that E and F are adjoint in both directions. So and then there is a very interesting consequence. Then you have these conditions. One thing which you can see here already, so this construction here is that you put for each weight vector in this picture, you put a whole category, and then you just sum them up. So, and a theorem of these two guys, Chuang and Rupier, they say if you have a categorification in this weak sense, then this has to hold automatically. So each weight space has to be a whole category. So let me write this down. So this is a proposition, 2-2 Chang and Rouquier, which says if C is a weak categorification of a finite dimensional vector representation of SL2V, and I take a weight space, so in this case, it's just space with one basis vector, generated by one basis vector here. And then I denote by C lambda the subcategory of C, so I should say the full subcategory, generated by all objects with class in V lambda. By this I mean I take the class and I go via my isomorphism of the categorification to the vector space V, and then I check whether this is lying in my V lambda, and if so, it is in my C lambda and otherwise not. Then the statement is, that my category C is isomorphic or equal to the direct sum of these C lambdas. So this is already a quite strong condition that I cannot just take any sort of category. And I found this quite amazing already, because these conditions are maybe technical, but they are not very strong. Okay? So I was planning to prove this, but maybe I shouldn't do this because there are much nicer applications. So let me just go on and make it one step further. going from a categorification in a weak sense to a categorification in a strong sense, or just a categorification. So strong sense. So and the problem what I have here is, okay, the beginning is easy, because a strong categorification should be, of course, a weak categorification. And then the next thing is plus something. And, okay, there is this paper of Zhuang and Rouquier where they write down what this means, and you read two pages, and it's quite technical. But I want to give you roughly the two ingredients and tell you the idea what is behind it and why this is useful. So plus two ingredients, namely T, which is a natural transformation of E squared. So it is a map from E squared to E squared. And an X, which is a natural transformation of E. So map from E to E, if you want. So, and they satisfy certain relations. So, and I tell you what these relations are for people who know a little bit. So, certain affine Hecke algebra relations. So, something which is terrible when you see it, but which is somehow at least conceptually nice. So this is the statement. So, and then, why is this useful? So this is some technical conditions. Why is this useful? There's this theorem of Zhuang Rouquier, which says that, first of all, every finite dimensional SL2 module has a categorification in this strong sense. Categorification in this strong sense. And you saw this already, namely this is, unfortunately, the example which I removed. This was the second, the non-silly example. You just have to say what is the T and X, and they are very easy to say. But these are exactly an example for this strong categorification. So these are not so difficult, and they exist. And now the second part is that there are somehow all of them, in some sense. So more precisely, let me call this C from above. So C above, that's what we had before. So, and the second statement is, let C be another categorification of the same module, of course. And then I want to take F in C, a simple object. So the one which is sitting F here, which corresponds to this V naught, with F, oh, I shouldn't call this F. So simple in C, such that it's killed by F. So if this simple module is projective, then this category C is equivalent to C above. So that means if you put a little bit of conditions, namely that the simple module which corresponds to this vector here is also projective, then there's only one sort of choice of categorification, and everything is unique. So why is this theorem a cool theorem? I think this is a cool theorem because suddenly you can construct equivalences of categories without even having a functor between these categories. You just say, okay, here's one category, here's the other, and we just have to check there is an action of E and F and H satisfying these conditions, and suddenly you know they are equivalent. And you don't even have necessarily a functor between them. And I want to give you at least an idea why these Hegge relations somehow can at least somehow be responsible for such a thing. So let me draw a picture for this idea. So here is the idea of the proof. But maybe I should write in brackets is that this is my point of view. So I don't know if the authors would agree with this. But so my point of view is this. Okay, we have here our irreducible representation, which we want to categorify. We have two categories. One is C above, and one is C. Now, we have a simple object, S, which belongs to this weight vector here in this category. And we have one over there. Okay? So and now we use this condition that it's projective. And we also know, so we know that this is projective by assumption. And we know this is projective by our construction of our C above. And it's also simple. So we also use that they have the same endomorphism ring. So that means the categories here somehow are equivalent. So categories are equivalent. So the category is generated by these S tilde and the S. And now the idea is just apply E on both sides. And you will create lots of modules by just seeing what is the image of E applied to this S and S tilde. You will create lots of things. And by construction, what you create is projective because your functors are exact. And at the end, because you categorify this module, you construct it enough to get a projective generator. And then these conditions come into the play, which tells you something about endomorphisms of these projective generators. And then these conditions, which I didn't write down, are exactly the axioms which tell you the endomorphism rings will be isomorphic. And therefore, you will have an equivalence of categories. So that means create projective generator on both sides, and then control them by this T and X. So show they have isomorphic endomorphism rings. Using T and X. So this is roughly the idea. And if you know, so I should come at least to the title of my talk, if you know about crystals and things like this, what I drew here somehow is two crystals, and I would say this is a categorification of the fact that the crystal here is the same as the crystal here. So this is roughly what I think is behind this. So, okay. And maybe one comment about this. So this can be generalized, this sort of idea, to prove many interesting equivalents of categories. So we, for instance, use this for understanding finite dimension modules over super Lie algebras to understand this category, which is not same as simple as this one here, and related categories, where we can do this game, but where we don't have really a strong theorem like this. So you can do this in a weaker setup as well, but you have to work more. And you have to have explicit examples. Of course, you can't do it just a general theorem. So, okay. But now I want to do another application of this. So this would be one application that you can create lots of equivalences of categories just from this abstract nonsense. And the other application is not theory. So the problem is, so we want to categorify tensor products of such modules. Okay, and of course you can say, good, I give you such a tensor product of a module, and now this tensor product will decompose into a direct sum of finite dimensional irreducible modules, and each of them we can categorify, so just take the direct sum. But I'm quite unhappy with this because I would like to see more of this monoidal structure. And this monoidal structure becomes much clearer if we leave a little bit of this SL2 for a normal Lie algebra and go to a quantized version. So rather quantized. So what I mean by this is instead of SL2 or the universal enveloping algebra of SL2, we want to have a quantized version of this thing. So I'll quickly tell you what this is. So this is an algebra. Oh, we were working over the complex number, so let's stick to this. This is an algebra over rational functions in Q, so indeterminate Q with over C, which is generated by E, F, and K plus and minus 1. And then relations are as follows. So I have to say how K and E commute. They do it like this. So they commute up to a power of Q, and then the EF minus the FE is some expression in K. So at least looks very similar to SL2. So it's some sort of deformation of this universal enveloping algebra. So now, the representation theory is exactly the same thing. So we again have this finite dimensional irreducible modules. The only thing which I have to change here, I have to change the brackets. So these are not round brackets anymore. So I change the bracket here. And I change this bracket here. So now I have to tell you what the brackets are. So the number n, no, n is the wrong. So for any integer k, I have this quantum number, which is q to the k minus q to the minus k divided by q minus q inverse. Or if you want, this is q to the k minus 1 plus q to the k minus 3 and so on, is q to the 1 minus k. So if you would plug in here for q equals to 1, you get just your number k back, and otherwise you get just the deformation, q deformation of your number k. So and everything looks exactly the same picture, but these monoidal, these tensor products are much more interesting, because if you would have a V and a W, two finite dimensional modules, then the obvious map from V tensor W to W tensor V, which just commutes V and W, is not a morphism of this UQSL2 modules. And this makes this category interesting, and this makes this tensor products interesting. So let me now say you quickly how one can use this to do some sort of knot theory. So let me write down this special case where we just tensor the two-dimensional representation n times. And now I want to do this in this Q version. So using this. So this would be then a module for this UQ SL2. So on the other side, forget the Q for the moment. I can permute the factors. So what would act here is the symmetric group by just permuting the n factors. And actually, these two things commute, but there might be some kernel, or there is some kernel here. So, and I have to put here now a Q version as well. And I don't want to explain what this CQ of SN is. This is, again, a Hecke algebra. So, so the Hecke algebras turn up here. But I want to tell you what this quotient is. Okay? And I don't tell you what the CQ SN is, and I don't tell you what the I is, but I tell you what this algebra is. So this algebra is called the Temporally-Lieb algebra. So, and to connect it with knot theory, I tell you another description of this thing. Namely, this is the following thing. This is the algebra with basis. So I just give you a basis given by so-called crossingless and n-tangles. So this gives you a vector space. And then multiplication is concatenation. With the rule that circles correspond to Q plus Q inverse. So what, I mean, it's more complicated to write this in words than drawing a picture again. So what I mean by this is the following thing. So an n-tangle. So let's say a 6-4 tangle is something which has 6 points on the top and 4 at the bottom, and I just connect them. For instance, like this, or let me put 8-6. Yeah? So this would be a tangle. Or a tangled diagram, I should say, more precisely. So, and crossingless means I'm not allowed to have crossings. So the one which I drew first is a crossingless one, and this would have a crossing. And now I can take such tangles, and I can multiply them by putting one on top of the other. So let me write this algebra in terms of generators and relations, and then related to this explicitly. So the Temporally-Lieb algebra, so it's generators. And this reminds you maybe for the symmetric group. So I have n minus 1 generators, which you should think of roughly like the simple transpositions of the symmetric group. It's only roughly because it's the simple transposition plus 1, unfortunately. So that leads to relations. So the simple transposition of I commutes with J if they are far away apart. So if they differ at least by 2. And then if they don't differ by 2, if they are neighbored, then you usually have the braid relations, which becomes such a relation in this algebra. And then you have a transposition squared is the identity. This becomes in this algebra. Let's see here. Yeah, so the CI is roughly 1 plus transposition TI, which you are used to. So, okay. So now let's draw this in these pictures. So the CI would be then this crossing this matching. So I have n strands and this cup cap at a point I. And for instance, let's check this relation. This means, let's say for C1, C2, C1, this would be C1, C2, C1. Just put one on top of the other. So this is the same thing as this one, as tangle pictures. So this would be this relation. Or if you put then, let's do this one. If you put CI and then CI on top, so now you have a problem. There is a circle. You should get rid of the circle. And this is what I wrote here. This should be Q plus Q inverse. So get rid of this and replace it by Q plus Q inverse, which is this relation. Yeah? So this algebra has this interpretation in terms of these tangles. So, and this is this thing here that they are centralized to each other is what is called the Schurweil duality in this special case. So, and now Jones and Rejetik and Turaev used this to define invariants of knots and tangles. So let me do this in 4 steps. So Jones and then Rejetikin and Turaev define the knot invariants or tangle invariants. Using this as follows. So the first step is you would have, if you have a tangle which has no crossings, so a tangle which has the same number of top and bottom points and no crossings, this construction just gives you an element in this algebra, which gives an element of this, which gives an endomorphism of this space. So what you get here is an element in this Temple-Lieb algebra, and then an endomorphism of V1 tensor N in this Q version. Yeah? So and then step 2, an arbitrary an entangle where you have crossings. What you should do is you should say, okay, this crossing is resolved by replacing it by this difference of this resolving and this one, and the other crossing is exactly the same, but I do the inverse of Q downstairs. Yeah? So if I do this for each crossing which appears, finally I get only tangles which don't have crossings anymore after finitely many steps. And each of these guys will give me a Temple-Lieb algebra element, hence an endomorphism. So that means I get a linear combination of endomorphisms. So what I get... linear combination of endomorphisms of VQ1 tensor N. Yeah, and actually, I mean, an endomorphism. I don't have, say, linear combinations. And the last step is to extend this to arbitrary tangles by just doing something which can increase the points. So this is a co-unit or unit. So and just a remark, if your tangle for 0-0 tangles, so this is exactly one, what knots are, we get a map from the zeros tensor product, so from CQ to CQ, call this phi, and then phi of 1 is what is called this famous Jones polynomial. And he proved that this is an invariant of knots. So, and now let me finish with one thing. So what does categorization helpful in this setup? So now we can do all this, what I wrote here, categorified. So we want to categorify this tensor product here. We want to categorify the action of quantum SL2. And we want to categorify this temporally Lieb algebra. And then we hope, and this is in fact true, that this knots become better than what Jones did originally. So we can distinguish knots which have the same Jones polynomial, because on the quotient group would have this level, this picture, but they are can distinguish because the functors are different. So let me state the last theorem, and then I'm finished. So this is actually, so this is my own theorem based on work of Frenkel and Hovanov, Bernstein, Frenkel, and Hovanov, which says the following. Let me see how I should formulate it. So number one, there is a categorification of all these tensor products for all n's. So that means it's a quotient group of a category, and we have the action of the E and the F, or the E and the F and the K. And more precisely, then there is a functor just the following. So I start here from the category of tangles, and I end up here in category, let me call it CAT. I like this because these are the first three names, letters of my name. So there is a category CN. So such that I have here objects, natural numbers, and then morphisms, tangles, and then on this side, for each natural number, I have my category, Cn, and for each tangle, I have a functor. So if it's an Nn tangle, I have a functor from Cn to Cm. So the statement is, if I have two tangles, if I have two diagrams of tangles which represent the same tangle, then I associate isomorphic functors. So this is a statement of this thing. So this is a bit cheating because I have to take here a bounded derived category. Okay, this is tricky. But now the good thing is of this categorification, then I can go to a second level. Namely, I have two morphisms. So if I have a a knot like this and a knot like this, I can have a surface between them. So these are cobordisms. And then here, I have natural transformations, at least up to scalars. Up to scalars. So that means a categorification, in this sense, has two advantages. It gives better knot invariance, and also we can go one step higher. We can go to invariance of knots or tangles, and also to surfaces. And this is the sort of why I think categorifications are interesting. I think I stop here. Thanks very much. That's a good remark. So the answer is...
Just repeat the question.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the question was whether this can detect things which can't be detected by Hovanov, and vice versa, probably. So the point is really, and I should say this very, very clearly, that these invariants are exactly Hovanov's. This has to be proved, and this is an interesting thing to prove, and it's exactly the same thing. And you get... actually Hovanov set up by taking this and take a certain subcategory inside here, I mean a certain subspace inside here, certain subcategory inside here, and just restrict your functors. And this is exactly on the nose Hovanov homology. Yeah. So I would say this is maybe, yeah, it explains you how you can embed Hovanov homology into this Rejetikin-Turayev picture on the one side. And on the other side, Hovanov homology would make this picture, which I have, computable. So these are the two sides.
Questions? Could you say how does the you use the Chuang-Rouquier machinery in this construction?
No, I don't use the Chuang-Rouquier in this construction at all. I use the sort of idea which I briefly explained in the for this proof, I used this sort of idea to show that these categories are equivalent to Hovanov's. So this is one way to prove it, I would say in the correct way. There is another proof to do this, going via results of Praden, who describes explicitly perverse sheaves on Grassmannians in terms of a quiver, and then you can do it by hand. So, but for the result itself, I don't use anything fancy.